Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your time.
Hi, welcome to our 87th episode of Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I do hope that you've all had a good summer and, like us, are eager to get on with our writing. I'm Heather and I'm the chair of this week's podcast, and today we'll be talking about horror. Stephanie uses the phrase doing your homework on the bus when we leave our planning to the very last minute. Well, I didn't work on the bus, but I definitely did at the breakfast table. Hopefully I've remembered everything I need to. This week we are a full house and I'm joined by Steph, Linda, Teresa, Nicola and Pat.
Hello!
This week Pat will be asking us to name the novel. Teresa will be reading from her work in progress. Linda will be amusing us with some slang. We'll all be talking about our writing lives. And Nicola will be telling us what's on her bedside table. But now over to Pat.
Name the novel.
This is an English comic novel written and illustrated by two brothers in the 19th century. It originated as an intermittent serial in Punch magazine in 1888 to 1889 and first appeared in book form with an extended text and added illustrations in 1892. It records the daily events in the lives of a London clerk, his wife, his son, and the comings and goings of numerous friends and acquaintances over a period of 15 months.
I've got an idea.
Okay.
I haven't read it, I don't know it.
No, but I think it's one of those that obviously
you either know,
you know
or
you don't.
Okay,
shall we move on? Right. Most of the humour, and there is quite a lot of it, derives from the protagonist's unconscious and unwarranted sense of his own importance, and the frequency with which this delusion is punctured by gaffes and minor social humiliations.
Sounds like an early version of The Office. I wonder if you got his inspiration from it.
I never saw The Office.
Just like that.
Yeah. Okay. Final? I think we're getting a lot of blank looks.
Yeah. Well, I'm no further forward. I've got a notion, but I'm not confident.
Okay. I don't think this third clue will help you very much either. Although its initial public reception was muted, the book came to be recognised by critics as a classic work of humour, and it's never been out of print. It helped to establish a genre of humorous popular fiction based on lower or lower middle class aspirations, and was the forerunner of numerous fictitious diary novels in the later 20th century. It's been the subject of several stage and screen adaptations, including Ken Russell's silent film treatment in 1964. It was a four-part TV film scripted by Andrew Davis, no less, in 2007.
2007? As recent as that.
And a widely praised stage version in 2011, in which an all-male cast of three played all the parts.
Well, I didn't have a TV in 2007, so that's why I don't know. What I've written down is, and this was on clue one, I think, Diary of a Nobody?
Correct.
So I've heard of it. I'm aware of it.
Who's that guy? George and Whedon Grossmith.
Yes, I knew it was something Smith, but not just Smith. Yeah.
I've heard of Nobody, but I've never heard of George and Whedon Grossmith.
Well, we need to read it, don't we? Sounds hilarious. Yes.
I did give you a little clue as well in had an idea of it in the first clue when I mentioned the comings and goings of numerous friends and acquaintances, because Charles Pooter, who is the protagonist. He has a friend called Cummings and he has a friend called Gold. And it's his little joke, which he's very, very sort of proud. He's always going on about the Cummings and goings in that sort of, self-important way. I don't know what it is, it's just very funny, silly.
Yes. No, it sounds really good.
Sounds good.
By that.
Yeah, I think.
I don't know how Teresa does it. How do you do it?
Well, I've heard of lots of books that I haven't read. But you know, I mean, let's say I've studied Victorian literature, but I haven't read all of it.
Okay.
You know?
Well, I'm happy to hear most of it.
Well, thank you very much.
Brilliant.
You're very welcome.
Put us in our place.
Teresa is going to update us on her work in progress.
Yes, well, this little scene takes place during the journey that Ronella and Kez are making towards the city of Mavropolis, where they're hoping to find and rescue her little sister. So they've overcome various obstacles along the way, including climbing an ice sheet, fighting off giant unextinct spiders, and narrowly avoiding starting a wildfire. And this is a quieter scene and a conversational scene. They're in a cave. Kez has been bitten by a spider, and so he's immobilised for 24 hours. Ronella's caught some fish, and she's made a little fire, and they're cooking. And this is where we get a little bit of background information about the origin of the longheads. And I suppose what I want to know is if it's too much explanation and if it's a bit boring. It's a quieter scene, and it's about halfway through the novel, so maybe the reader is ready for a bit more information. But that's where it's at. So, as we open the scene, Kez is talking about his people. Well, you know, the first generation were all scientists. They found a way to make something that works. We think we can make our own from metal too. People are working on it. So he's talking there about the cigarette lighter that he has. What do you mean they were all scientists? Ronella was keeping an eye on the fire, adding just enough twigs to keep it burning slowly. Scientists made us, and our grandparents were all brought up by scientists. So how did you become unextinct? Kez smiled. The truth is, we never really were extinct. Do you know what DNA is? Of course I do. Ronella turned the fish. It's why I have green eyes, like my grandpa Leo, and a strong will, like my grandma Jehona. You get some from your mum and some from your dad, and that makes you who you are. Yes, but I bet you don't know that every one of you has a little bit of longhead DNA in them. Ronella thought about this. Do you mean that our ancestors lived together? They must have lived together and made families together. The fish was cooked. It was hot in the cave, and Ronella decided to let the fire die down. She passed one of the sticks to Kez. Tell me about your tattoos, he said, holding her arm as he took the fish. Later, she said, you finish telling me about your people while we eat this. I'll tell you about my family after that. Okay, so anyway, some scientists decided that if they collected all these little bits of DNA, by the way, they call us Neanderthals, not longheads, they could recreate Neanderthal people. Why would they do that? Ronella was blowing on a piece of hot fish in her fingers. The thing about your people is they can't just imagine something without having to make it real. Ronella wasn't sure whether to be offended or not. My people, we just make cheese and grow olives. Well, anyway, without getting too scientific, they managed to make the first generation about 75% Neanderthal. The mothers who carried them were all scientists in a special science city in a place called Siberia. So that generation were raised in a very isolated community of scientists, but basically with human parents and the same kind of education as your people got in that place. So how come you're here? Well, our grandparents asked to be given somewhere to live apart from your people. In fact, when they understood how much stronger we were, the scientists got scared of us. If we'd shown any tendency to violence, I think they would have destroyed us. But instead, they let us move to isolated places to create our own communities. There are more longheads? Yes, about 20 towns and villages around the world. But of course, we've no way of knowing how many have survived. In the before time, when they had aeroplanes and internet cameras, the scientists used to monitor us. We were an experiment to them. Kez threw his stick and fish bones into the dying fire. He rinsed his hands with water from the water skin and passed it to Ronella so she could do the same. Now it's your turn. Tell me about the tattoos while there's still enough light to see them.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I thought there was just the right amount of information. I thought I found it fascinating.
And really, chilling too. Yeah. The fact that humans can create other humans and then be scared of them. I found it quite chilling. I think the undercurrent of that would be very interesting to a child.
Mm. I think that you need to have this kind of information. I don't think there's too much exposition there, because children at that age group may or may not have yet studied about Neanderthals, etc. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very... In fact, I looked up photos of Neanderthals because I wanted to see the long head. How it was long.
And real photos. The real Neanderthals. Yeah, the real.
Absolutely, the real ones. Some of them were still talking. No, but I thought that was a very good description.
I was confused.
Who was speaking in the middle?
It wasn't so much about who was speaking. I think it was the they and the your people, and I just got a little bit confused about whose people these were and when are we talking about.
Yeah.
And I did. And moving on from that, when Kez says at the beginning, I bet you don't know that every one of you has a little bit of longhead DNA in them.
Right.
And Ranella thought about this. This didn't match with my sort of knowledge of Ranella. I would have thought that she would have responded a little bit more aggressively to that.
Right,
Because there's such antipathy, between the two groups.
Yeah.
I would have thought that she might be more taken aback by that.
Okay, you're right.
Rather than thoughtful about it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I did think that when she asked why would they do that, why would they try and recreate, I thought that is a very good question.
Mm-hmm.
Just to say, the thing about your people is that they can't just imagine something without having to make it real.
Mm.
I didn't think that was a good enough answer.
The thing about humans, I think it was, I totally took the answer.
See, I'm trying to avoid using humans because the longheads are just a different kind of human.
It does make it a bit confusing, doesn't it?
But without using Homo sapiens and things like that,
we do.
But it does become clear. I mean, I was a little bit, what does that mean? Yeah. But then as they carried on talking, it became clear what he meant.
But even if it did say humans or whatever,
It wasn't
still
a very
doesn't
good
explain
answer.
Why.
No, but
so
maybe
to do it.
But at the same time,
unless you're holding that back.
Well, no, it's not. It's Kez's interpretation of why it happened, perhaps. But anyway, if it's not satisfactory, then obviously there's room for improvement. Mm-hmm. So
I saw it as a way of future conversations, because to give Ranella time to, it's like, just a minute, you said yesterday, what was that? What did you mean? To get it all in context, I downloaded printed quite a few of your previous chapters to kind of get my head in the right place to read it.
Yeah.
And I just saw it as a step to something else.
I mean, it is difficult out of context.
Yes.
And as soon as I started reading, I thought, I haven't explained the first thing that Kez is saying, that he has a lighter. Yeah.
That was my confusion. We think we can make our own from metal too. I was thinking...
And I think we don't always.
We can make our own people. Yeah. We can
make our own
first generation of scientists.
I perhaps cut it, extracted it badly.
But it was just an extract. Yeah. One thing I really, really liked was the way that you've put this conversation around cooking and eating the fish. So you've got her turning the fish.
Yeah.
You've got her handing them. You've got her handing. So that, to me, really brought it to life, and I could see the two of them having a chat, and her feeding him the fish and blowing on the hot fish.
I thought that was
a really nice touch. But I think it's the first draft, and I didn't get particularly confused. There was a lot of words like scientists, your people, my people, and there might be
a better way
of doing that.
I think
in terms of the information and the question that you've asked us to address, I think it's great, and suddenly all becomes starting to make sense to me now.
It's important as Heather said before, that information comes across.
Yeah. I haven't really worked out what the longheads call the other people.
Right.
That's my problem. If there was a tag, as I thought, in this environment, they might call them the farmers because they live more by hunting, and Ryan Nell's people farm. But in the wider context, when they're talking about the world and Siberia and scientists, they can't call them farmers. So they need I need a term. If anybody has any ideas, write on the Facebook group.
I did notice in one paragraph here, well, anyway, without getting too scientific, it does say very isolated community of scientists, but basically with human parents. And so we are using the word human here.
That's a mistake. Thank you for pointing that out. Yeah.
Are the Neanderthals not considered human?
Exactly, they are. They are human. Yes. So that's a mistake, so thank you for pointing that out. Yeah.
I think it may be that the longheads call themselves something else.
Yes.
And that Ranella's people call themselves something and the longheads call them something different. I think that's...
That would actually make a very good conversation, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Between the two of them, actually exploring...
We don't call ourselves longheads.
Yes. Right. Well, there's call something ourselves, in there, isn't there?
Well, he says that he brings in the term Neanderthal, which I suppose the reader would already have worked that out, I think.
Possibly.
Or certainly the adult reader.
Yeah.
But it's just... But you can't have this explanation.
But I do like the thing about your people is they can't just imagine something without having to make it real. So that's saying that this race that Ranella comes from are scientists, they're curious, they're...
I do believe that there are scientists now working on recreating mammoths.
I believe that
there are scientists working on creating Neanderthals. Yeah. It would not surprise me. And so that's kind of what I'm trying to say there, but I'm putting it in Kez's mouth in a slightly childish way. So, and it doesn't. If it doesn't work, that's fine. We can change it.
No, I like that, and I think that's nice that we're getting the longhead point of view. You know, the trouble with that lot, because it's a kind of, you know, we've got two different communities, and you know, the longheads are saying, well, Ranella's people, they're all just overly fussy, and actually, we're the engineers. We make things. Mm. And they're scientists and they're airy-fairy and they just have to go and fiddle around.
It's Romeo and Juliet, but without the romantic. Yes. It's the opposing houses. Yeah. It could be sectarianism, it could be racism, it could be anything in a different scenario.
Absolutely.
But it's a kind of archetype.
Yes. I like it a lot.
Well, when I read that line, I just thought, maybe Kez doesn't know any more than that. Maybe he's just, you know... Not...
It's an interpretation, but
It's what he's heard his people saying to one another, oh, that lot.
What I'm most amazed by, Teresa, is where is it all coming from? It's just like it downloaded into your head and now it's coming out on the paper. It's amazing. Yeah.
Well, it's what we all do, isn't it? You know, I mean, everything comes from nothing, and that's the fun of writing, isn't it? It's like, you know, Mary Magdalene exists and deserves a place in the world, and you know, all of your... You know, Grace and the different characters, you know, that you come up with. Yeah, it's fun, isn't it? When it works, when it's going well. Anyway, thank you very much.
As always, I can't wait for the next bit.
Yeah.
Linda is going to amuse us with some slang.
I am. The British and me, the American, they're always coming up with things, and I have to say, what does that mean? What does that mean? You know, like when you said, oh, and then happy as Larry. And I thought, well, I didn't know what the heck that meant, but apparently it means happy. Everything is okay. But I didn't know if it was happy as Larry meant Larry was not happy or what. So
yeah, it could be ironic.
Yeah, could be.
So I've been online. I went to several places and looked, and there are many of them, comparing American slang with British slang. I thought I would choose some that I haven't heard from you and see whether or not, if I give you the American slang word, could you tell me what the British slang word is for it?
Okay.
The first one would be knowledgeable.
Knowledgeable.
Brain box.
Knowledgeable.
SWAT.
Yeah. SWAT. Yeah.
Knowledgeable doesn't sound like slang.
That's not slang. Go on.
No, it's not a slang word.
Yeah.
Knowledgeable.
Oh, okay.
Know all?
No. Know your onions.
Oh, to know your onions.
Oh, see the people
you're praying. So that's you've got us now, right?
Yeah, we understand that. Yeah. To know your onions, yeah.
What if you say someone is suspicious? What's your word for it?
A slang word for suspicious.
Cagey?
No.
Spivvy.
It depends whether you are suspicious of something, or whether
they're behaving
suspiciously.
Sneaky, sly.
How about dodgy?
Dodgy.
Oh, dodgy. Yes.
Dodgy. Well, yeah. Dodgy. Dodgy.
Well, dodgy.
So I'm thinking, if you were an American and people said these words, you wouldn't know what they mean.
Well, of course, we know what knowledgeable means.
No, but if somebody said, "Well, dodgy," we would understand. But you're saying an American wouldn't understand if something was well dodgy.
So let me switch and do that.
Okay.
Let's do the British slang and see if you know what the American version would be. How about a dog's dinner?
A mess.
Mess.
In America, a dog's dinner, what would Americans say for a mess? Well, for people from your area, you'd probably say it's about as attractive as an alligator in a something or other. You'd probably come up with some weird simile.
How about an alligator in a tutu? But the dog's dinner here, the American version, is dressed nicely.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, because sometimes you would say somebody was dressed up like a dog's dinner.
Yeah.
But I think
meaning very sort of fussy.
Yeah.
But we would say, for us, it's a right dog's dinner. It's a mess.
Oh, really?
Mm.
Okay.
Yeah, to be
that
dressed up would be dressed to the nines.
Okay.
Yeah.
How about made redundant? I hear you people talk about that sometimes.
Means
you people.
Your job.
Longer useful.
No longer useful.
Laid off.
Really?
Fired.
But redundant, what does redundant by itself mean? What is the...
If something is redundant,
to requirements.
Yes, it's no longer of use.
Surplus to
so, you know, the typewriter has become redundant in the age of the word processor.
Okay.
Something like
so
that.
Being made redundant is referring to when you lose your job. And in
your
Britain,
job, your job, it no longer exists.
Yeah.
Okay.
They're not giving it to somebody else.
Yeah. So it's not that you've been fired, and that's quite an important differentiator, because people that have been dismissed from their jobs,
mm-hmm.
they would hire someone else for it.
Yeah, whereas if you're made redundant, the job no longer exists. And and from a British point of view, you want people to know that you were made redundant, not that you were fired.
Yeah,
because there's a sort of stigma about being fired from a job.
Yeah.
Right.
Less of a stigma about being made redundant, although it can be a euphemism.
And also, employers use the phrase made redundant, and then they often then hire someone to do the same job under a different name. It's a way, a way of getting...
So there are laws that...
I know there are laws.
Yeah, and they
still
they usually work out how to get around them.
Well, redundant to me means, you know, that's redundant. Like you say something and there's... the same kind of...
It's like I reversed backwards.
Yes, that's redundant.
Yeah, that's redundancy.
You're talking grammatically
redundant. Right. And so I couldn't quite figure that with a job. You know.
Well,
but
I'll be talking about something redundant in the next podcast.
All right, okay. All right, and what if you say up the duff?
that's pregnant.
You got it.
A bun in the oven.
Bun in the
oven. Okay.
Up the duff.
Yeah.
Yay! Ding, ding, ding.
So what do you say?
It's quite old-fashioned, I don't think.
Yeah, well, I presume it refers to a duff pudding in the pudding club. It was another old-fashioned thing.
Yeah.
But what a duff
pudding
is, nobody knows anymore.
What would you say, slang? I know you say
slang. Knocked up.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
That sort of sounds like someone's done it to you, I suppose.
And here's one that I kind of thought, wow, that's funny. Strawberry creams.
Strawberry creams? Dreams? Is it rhyming slang?
No, I wonder... Well, I don't think so. I wonder where this slang comes from that you guys don't know. It means in America it would be breast. Strawberry creams. You know?
No, never heard that expression.
No. Okay. So you refer to a woman's breasts as strawberry creams?
Well, that's what you refer to.
A lot of words for women's breasts, but strawberry creams is not one of them.
No, never heard of that one. Yeah. You haven't just got somebody's private list.
No,
which
I got
sites
from
were
online.
You looking at, Linda?
I went to many, many of them, so it's not just one. That's why I haven't really
credited. Give us a couple more.
Okay, how about someone who's... Oh, I like this one. Bog roll.
Toilet roll.
Ding, ding, ding.
Why is it a bog?
Yeah.
Because it was always outside, because they used to put peat down...
Maybe it's something from the military when they had to dig latrines, so maybe that's come in that way.
Yeah. So, okay. So you call the
privy?
Yeah, we have privy, WC.
Netting?
No, we're talking netting. Just the toilet paper.
Yeah, but it's a specific kind of
bog roll is
toilet roll.
The bog is the toilet, so that's where
the bog, everyone will know what you're talking about.
All right, okay. And here's one I don't think you'll know, but let's see. A scouser.
Somebody from Liverpool.
Everybody knows that.
They eat scouse.
Sorry to all our lovely listeners in Liverpool.
Some of them eat scouse. Scouse is a kind of local dish.
Lamb stew.
They all sound like the Beatles when they talk.
Oh, well, souse is a dish.
Scouse. And they're called scousers because they eat scouse. Yeah.
What is scouse? I don't know.
It's a lamb stew.
But it's properly called lobscouse.
I don't know.
How's it different from Lancashire hot pot?
It comes from Liverpool.
Lancashire hot pot's got potato sliced, and Lancashire hot pot traditionally would have kidney in it as well.
Okay.
Or oysters.
Yes. Oh. And
made me hungry, ladies.
Yeah, I know.
Welcome to neck chops or mutton chops.
Yes.
Whereas I think scouse
might be a different
is like just chopped meat. I don't think they tend to use the bones.
Yes.
Yeah, it's the cheek.
So it's a bit like mutton stew.
Yeah.
Okay, ladies. Welcome to the cookery podcast.
Yeah, you got us on one of our favourite subjects.
Yeah. There's one other here that I want to give you. How about toff?
Toff is a posh person.
An aristocrat.
You're right. Oh,
and you might
more.
Call somebody toffee-nosed.
if they have aspirations.
You know, somebody that's toffee-nosed would be somebody that's a little bit superior.
What about a daft cow?
That's a very silly person. Usually a
woman.
Bit of a sexist term, isn't it? Referring to
it's usually a woman.
It's descriptive. Yeah.
Well, a cow is female.
That's true.
You tend to call a daft cow would tend to be a daft cow, as you said. It would depend on where you come from.
Or back in the '60s, television, a silly moo.
Silly moo.
Yes, that's right.
Oh, okay.
I've gone it. Yeah. You silly moo.
Yeah.
Idiot, we say.
Well, so do we, but...
Yeah, it's just a more idiomatic way of saying it. Yeah.
Okay, one more and that's all. One off.
Well, a single event.
None of those you understood?
You didn't understand what
you didn't understand what any of those were?
Well, I hadn't heard of many of them.
I think it's probably more idioms than slang.
Is it?
No, I would say more idioms rather than slang.
Okay.
Mixture. Yeah. Good to know we know our own language.
Yeah. How many did you get right? Not a lot.
Yeah,
we got all of them right.
It's
only strawberry cream.
Nobody ever heard that.
Yeah. That's made up.
Yes.
You got that off an American website, aren't
you? No, I didn't. Well, maybe.
Okay, so we've put this off long enough. We now need to talk about our writing lives. For me personally, I wanted to enter the competition for this year's Lit Fest. Oh. So I have sat dutifully on my writing day, scribbled out a couple of thousand words.
Brilliant.
I don't know whether they're any use at all, but those are my efforts. I'm quite proud of myself.
Well done.
Good for you, Heather.
A new work.
A new work, completely different.
Excellent.
Than anything I've done before. But yes, we'll see.
Excellent.
How about the rest of you? I've had a bit of a summer break. I can talk to you at great length about my reading life. But no, it's not just reading.
Research.
But I've been doing jottings, not even research. Jottings and observations.
Oh, good.
And as I've been sort of round and about. And I've just sort of, like, seen things or heard things. And I've just sort of made a few little notes to remind me. Because as I saw them, I thought, oh, there's some scope there.
Mm. Right.
I haven't got anything of a story, but what triggered the hope that at some point a story will emerge from it is a story of a funeral, but it involves former lovers, drugs, dancing outside the church in the graveyard, and such like things. So,
sounds good.
Is this a funeral you went to?
No, I didn't go.
All right. But there was a funeral that involved.
Yes.
Okay.
Also, sort of like some characters that I observed. One of which was a man whose way of drinking his breakfast coffee was absolutely. I was transfixed by it. I've never seen anybody drink their coffee in the way this guy did. Well, might have to wait for the stories.
Yes. Okay.
But I have to describe it.
Yes.
Because I haven't quite.
Worked out how to explain this,
right? There was a couple who I completely got wrong on the first time I saw them, and then
That's interesting.
Yeah. And there was a young mother at the optician's with the little boy, and she looked about 15, 16. The little boy was about 4 or 5.
Ooh.
And then when she was making another appointment, said, oh, no, it's all right. That'll be all right, because my mother will look after the others. And I'm thinking, what?
Yes.
No, she barely looked older, but she was lovely. But she just looked so young and skinny.
Some people
and everything.
Do.
I thought,
some people do.
Just an interesting character. Mm,
yeah.
I thought,
mm-hmm. Yes.
Some scope there. So I've got all these little ideas.
Excellent.
That bubbling need to under. Ferment.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have been writing a lot for work, but I've made a big realisation, which is that critiquing too detailed overwhelms me and kills my inspiration. So I've got to remind, when it comes to my turn, I've got to remind you guys to focus, please, on the story itself only, not the grammar, the spelling.
Mm-hmm. Right,
that's
right.
Because what I end up with is pages full of notes that I'm terrified to look at because, you know, I know you say you shouldn't go back and edit until you've done the first draft, but what I find is I get bogged down in the detail. And it stops me completely in my tracks. So that's an interesting realisation about myself, because I've been thinking a lot about my writing and whether I want to do it anymore. And so I think that might help. But I have written, I did a marketing challenge which involved writing your origin story along the hero's journey. And the tutor of this course was very much outlining the hero's journey, and he came at it from a different point of view, again from the one that I've seen in things we've done, which was really interesting. And I ended up writing 4,721 words on my story, but it wasn't even my life. It was a bit memoirish, I suppose, but it wasn't even, it was just over 5 years of my life. And it's very much structured in the ordinary life. Something changed, had a revelation, went on a journey, mentors appeared, talismans arrived, you know, the special gadget. And I wrote it over 5 pages on a website, because the point of this was that I can't send pay-to-send traffic to my homepage because they don't like my domain. So I thought, oh, I'll write the story, put it on another website entirely, and then lead people through the 5 pages. So each page ends on a cliffhanger to make people go to the next page, and I'm having incredible retention. So the number of people that go in at page one who get through to page 5, either they'd click in and not reading, which they might be, but it's very high retention through that, and then I can jump them to where I want to at the end. So that's good. But then I had to record it. I had to speak to camera and record it as well. That was part of the challenge, and so I had to then do that spontaneously. And because I'd written it all out first, I had it all really clear in my head, so I've done that. It was quite a massive task, and it got quite emotional at some points, but... Yeah. I'm really pleased I did it. So,
good. Excellent. Well done.
Wow. And I read those 5 pages.
Oh, yeah, I sent it to you and said, don't critique it.
Right. But I thought they were very interesting.
Oh, thank you.
It was good insight into Nicola.
Yeah, lots of people have commented on the video to say they didn't know a lot of it.
Yeah. Well, I have had quite a turn of events with Mary Magdalene, she took off in a direction I didn't intend to go, and I thought, oh, what are you doing? what am I going to do with this? But it's very interesting to find that character kind of invented a different story, a leg of the story, I think. So that's been quite a lot of fun to try to chase it down, this new development, and see what's going to happen next. And I've been doing some nonfiction. I've been researching a lot on what will probably be a memoir, or I'm not exactly sure, fictionalized memoir. So my summer has been busy with writing, and I've read a lot. So reading for writing.
Oh, yeah, so, yeah. It's been great.
Yeah, I think we've all had a good time for reading.
Yes.
Yeah.
I can't wait to hear the new twist from Mary Magdalene.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? Intriguing. So I've got I'm progressing with Vranella's journey to the city. She's getting close now. So there's a couple of chapters which you won't have heard on the podcast before the scene that I read today. I've also, a bit like Pat, had some inspiration from my travels, and specifically 3 days I spent in Manchester, and I felt very inspired to... There's a non-fiction piece I want to write, and also I've got an idea for a fictional piece, both inspired by libraries in Manchester. So that was really exciting. Yeah. I had a really wonderful 3 days there. As far as Vranella goes, I think the chapters that I've written, when I sat down to do it, came quite easy, and I think it was because I'd plotted them a little bit in advance, and that's where I am now. I need to do some more plotting, because the next bit that I've written, the chapter following on from the bit that I read today, is going very slowly. I sit down and I write a paragraph, and then I think I need to plot this, really, because I'm trying to write and forcing it. So that's where I need to go with Vranella.
I was going to ask you, how it's working in terms of, this idea's come to you and, it's flowing, seems to be flowing. I was going to ask you how it's...
I had a good flow for 2 or 3 chapters. I did have a good flow. And I kind of know what happens next, because she's carrying on alone. Kez will be sort of a few hours behind her when he's fully recovered from the spider bite. And then she's going to encounter this gang, this sort of semi-military gang of slightly older children from the city.
Oh.
Are going to...
So have you got the whole story planned out, or is
roughly,
it evolving as you go?
There are details I don't know.
No.
But roughly I know I can see the ending.
Okay.
I can see her... I can see where she sees Larkin. That's going to be, I hope, quite a funny scene, because Larkin has been transformed and made ready for sale. So that's going to be quite funny when Vranella sees what they've done to her, And I can see her final encounter with the one-eyed woman, and I know how they escape.
Oh, so I do know quite a lot. Wow.
And I know quite a lot about this gang of children. I'm not confident that I've quite got the world of the city in my mind, because it's very different from the world that Renelle's come from. But I see it as a kind of militarised community.
Okay.
And possibly sustained by slaves. This is partly because I've done a lot of reading that I've been doing about Africa and different things, but also almost so many cultures throughout history have been built on slaves, and I think this might be how this culture survives with this military regime. But anyway, I've got ideas, I've got certain structure points, but it's getting from here to there is where I'm a little bit, not stuck, but it's slowed down. It's more like wading through treacle now. But
I say the middle bit's the hardest.
Yeah.
The soggy middle, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've spent the summer reading, and a bit of knitting. It's been brilliant. There's been books like Leanne Moriarty's 9 Perfect Strangers was a book that I bought the minute it came out and didn't get around to reading it. I've read so many books that I have been on my Sudoku waiting to be read, and it's been brilliant. It's been lovely. And I haven't really written anything long form, but I've been...
You know, sometimes you get feelings about things, and I think when you have strong feelings about things, I think poetry is a way to kind of get that out. So I have been doing little ditties in my head and then scribbling them down. I wouldn't say there's anything fully formed there. But it's been great. And it's been great having the time, you know, not feel guilty that I haven't done something and so on. And just
give yourself a holiday.
Yeah, reading. And at one point we were staying somewhere that didn't have Wi-Fi. And that was just wonderful.
Oh, my God. Because,
you know, I just read.
It is really liberating, actually.
It's lovely.
You know, not having to check what's happening on
Facebook. I couldn't get emails, you know. And so
I had 8 weeks and it felt like hell.
Well, no, it was lovely. Once a day we could go somewhere to pick up emails and that sort of thing. But just to be in that environment, it was quiet, it was peaceful. You know, I had a cup of tea and a book. Well, what more could you want? It's lovely. So...
Can you tell us how many hours per day you saved without Facebook and Twitter and email?
Well, I don't know, but working. I was reading, you know, some books I read in a day and a half, just galloping through them.
Yeah.
And some I haven't even updated on my Goodreads list. I mean, I must do it. But, you know, the challenge that Goodreads target yourself with number of books. There were like consecutive days when I'm knocking books off my Kindle. It was good. It was really good.
I think that's a good point, though. I think we do waste an awful lot of time on the internet. I mean, I certainly do. Like, you know, every morning I've got to read Facebook and look at my emails and before I do anything
else. Just the news. I mean,
I think one of the
don't get involved in the news.
One of the issues is the same device that we're using for writing is connected to the internet, so it's this multifunction tool, the computer, which allows you to distract yourself very easily from the task in hand.
Bring back the typewriter.
Please not.
But do you know there is a website thingy that you can install, and you set it for how many hours you think you want to write, and it will not allow you to access Facebook or email or anything else.
Yeah.
And that's kind
and you
of...
And you can turn off your notifications on your device.
Yeah, there's lots of
things
you can
do. Or you can disconnect it from the internet and just type, you know.
But then at the same time, you suddenly need to do some research.
I know.
You need to get on the internet because you suddenly think, you know...
I know.
And then another hour goes past.
Yeah. Yeah.
You write longhand like me.
Do you actually write longhand? You don't write on the computer?
Most of the time. Oh. First draft is usually longhand, and then I go and type it up. Mm-hmm.
There was a time when I was in graduate school, I always wrote longhand.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep thinking about it because it seemed to me that doing it that way, I was feeling it through my fingers, seeing it with my eyes.
It's a different process.
It is, I've in your brain.
I've always used a word processor, I suppose I'm that generation when I went to work in 1978, I worked with computers, so...
Yeah. I just, you know, my writing is actually painful for me, physically painful, whereas typing is just effortless because...
My handwriting's so appalling, even I can't read it.
Yeah, that's another issue for me as well.
That's because you're in the medical profession, that's a prerequisite for being a medic, isn't it?
Yeah, your handwriting's rubbish, off you go to the medical profession.
Who needs GCSEs? Right?
Yeah.
I'll just write appalling. But no, I seriously do think, because I'll sort of write longhand, then I'll type up, and quite often, if I've sort of reached a point where I think, oh, I'm stuck, so I'll just go and type up what I've done so far, and then I get to the end of that, and I will carry on typing, and the story comes there.
Okay.
But I'm sure my brain works differently.
Yeah,
it does.
When I'm writing and when I'm sort of typing.
Yeah.
The reason I haven't gone back to it is because laziness, I suppose, because I'm thinking, well, if I write it longhand, then I'm going to have to go back and type it in.
But then I edit as I type as
you
well.
You do. Okay.
Slightly.
Yeah, well, you know, I think I'm going to try it now because I do recall how much more productive I seem to be, and it seemed to me that there was a better flow because there's something about your brain and your handwriting and your reading it, etc.
And then you can write anywhere. Because,
it's like we say about walking.
Yeah.
You know, the writing and walking. Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's the physical and the...
Yeah, it's slower. And things come to you through that, I think.
And you can sit in a cafe and write, whereas lugging your computer around is just far too painful.
Right, that's true.
I love my computer.
Well, thank you, everybody. So, some bright spark suggested that we talk about horror. That'd be me, then. I remember spending hours and hours scaring myself to death reading Dennis Wheatley. I should perhaps have been doing my English homework and learning all about grammar and punctuation, which would have come in a lot more useful now, but that's a different story. My interest was probably fuelled for an escape from Enid Blyton and the Famous Five and Laura Lee Hope's The Bobsey Twins, I suppose I was made to read. But I've been surprised by how many of my friends and family started reading horror as a teenager, and maybe, again, the same escapism. People moved on to things like the Point Horror series, Stephen King's work, really hugely popular and still today. But when I started looking at it, I decided that I wasn't going to look at individual novels and writers. I'd try and find out a little bit more about why we like it. Why do we like horror? And I found an interesting article by a woman called Elizabeth Barrett, B-A-R-R-E-T-T-E. I found it on Wikipedia, but then found her article. And she starts by saying, "People often wonder what makes scary stories so attractive. Why do we find thrillers thrilling? Why does horror horrify us? What gives creepy tales their compelling magnetism? How does horror work? How do you write a successful horror? What elements do good scare stories have in common? What on earth possesses us to read the blasted things after dark anyway? The answers lie in the human psychology and biology, in the software and hardware of our brains. The old fight or flight reaction of our evolutionary heritage once played a major role in the life of every human. Our ancestors lived and died by it. Then someone invented the fascinating game of civilization, and things began to calm down. Development pushed wilderness back from settled lands. War, crime, and other forms of social violence came with civilization, and humans started preying on each other. But, by and by, daily life calmed down. We began to feel restless, to feel something missing, the excitement of living on the edge, the tension between hunter and hunted. So we told each other stories through the long dark nights. Sometimes we told happy stories or sacred stories, but when the fires burned low, we did our best to scare the daylights out of each other. The rush of adrenaline feels good, our hearts pound, our breath quickens, and we can imagine ourselves on the edge. Yet we also appreciate the insightful aspects of horror. Sometimes a story intends to shock and disgust, but the best horror intends to rattle our cages and shake us out of complacency. It makes us think, forces us to confront ideas we might rather ignore, and challenges preconceptions of all kinds. Horror reminds us that the world is not always as safe as it seems, which exercises our mental muscles and reminds us to keep a little healthy caution close at hand. Over the years, we've developed a wide range of scary stories and motifs. Horror may involve things that could never happen in this world, like attacks by indescribable supernatural monsters that might happen, like a comet smashing into the planet during our lifetimes, or that definitely happen, like mass murder. Each type plays on different fears, and the most effective play on the oldest, most visceral fears left over from ancestral experience or childhood imagination. Yet all of them have some elements in common, certain motifs that appear throughout the genre, however widely separated in time and setting. Which I thought in itself was quite fascinating. And she goes on to talk about aspects that you would put into a horror story. Mm. The unknown, the unexpected, the unbelievable, the unseen, the unconscious, the unstoppable. And it's a fascinating article.
I found an article talking about horror and saying that, you know, there's a lot of cliche in horror, but actually it works for the reader. So the cellar, the dark alley, the dark room, the sense that somebody's watching you, the unseen observer.
Well, you might call those cliches, or you might call them the essential elements of the genre.
Yes, exactly.
But also, maybe they're more necessary in horror. I think the psychological thing there and the fight and flight.
Yeah,
that's theorising is interesting. But also, maybe if you're reading horror or watching horror, you need something familiar to hang on to. Mm-hmm. So you get, you know, the kid watching, you know, the old thing about watching Doctor Who from behind the the sofa. So you want to be frightened, mm-hmm. but you want the safety. And so, to some extent, your cliches, that familiarity with those locations and those tropes are your little safety net, because you know this is just a horror story.
And you know when somebody, in a horror story, you know when somebody goes into the house and they put their key in the lock and they flip the light switch and the light doesn't come on. You just know something awful's going to happen, you know.
Yeah. And you say, no, don't do that!
Why would you go down those steps and no light
you
at the bottom?
Stupid woman.
But the other thing is, I think the reason that some of the writers are so successful, I mean, Neil Gaiman is one that's very good at the moment, is because they continue to surprise us. They have those cliches and those expected elements in it, but we don't know what's going to happen next. And
well,
Stephen King was very good for that as well.
I mean, with all good writing, you know, people say there's nothing original, there are no original stories, but it's doing something new, it's putting that different twist on it
absolutely.
And taking you somewhere you don't expect to go.
I remember one time I was about 19 or 20, living in a shared house, and I went into the bath. And it was, I don't know, late morning, I suppose. It must have been a weekend. And I started to read The Stand by Stephen King. And I just couldn't get out of the bathroom. I was so scared about the imagination that there might be someone. I was convinced there was someone in the house, basically. But I was safe as long as I stayed in the bathroom. And it was just ridiculous. I had to keep topping up the water until someone came home. It was crazy.
Well, as I've told you before, I very often have to go to the end of the book and read the ending first in order to keep myself from getting so tense from not knowing. I don't read horror normally or thrillers because they frighten me to death. Recently, someone loaned me a book and just, you know, went on forever about how good it was. And the other person who had loaned it to her loved it so much and suggested I might like it. I don't know why. And so I thought, oh, it sounds really horrible. I mean, frightening. So I went to the back of the book. I was going to try to read it. I went to the back of the book, and I looked at the last couple of pages, and there was another incident. I'm sure it was going to lead to a sequel or something. Another incident that was absolutely chilling in the end of that book, and I thought, absolutely no way I will read it, because I know that it's not going to be a good ending. It's not going to be a good ending.
I'm not a great lover of the horror genre.
No, I've had to stop.
And
it scares me too much at night.
You know, psychological thrillers are, I suppose, a kind of modern day horrors. Mm. That's what I find the most chilling. You know, when some alien bursts in and a creature comes out of somebody's stomach, or you know, those things, those kind of gross out things where you feel completely,
there's a lot of blood.
But because they're not believable,
that's the thing. Because
when it's believable, that's what horrifies me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you know, you could actually have somebody that, you know.
Serial killers are more horrifying to me than horror books because of that.
Let's face it, real life, the news, it can be more horrifying. But I mean, this is the thing that I have. I would say I don't read horror, but I'll qualify that in a moment. But because I'm a rational person and I don't believe in supernatural things, and therefore that doesn't scare me. And I've read The Haunting of Hill House and was like totally unimpressed, which is supposedly this great horror story, but you know, and I've read a more modern take on, I think it was a Peter James book, and I just thought, well, yeah, but if this house wanted to kill you, it would have killed you by now. You know, it's just like, it doesn't make sense. And
horror, I suppose, is on that
it's a massive spectrum.
Linear scale. You know, we've got psychological thrillers, we've got adventure action thrillers, you know, with guns and scary things happening. We've got, you know, Silence of the Lambs type of stuff. Stephen King with people having, you know, carry supernatural powers. I mean, Stephen King, I guess, is the sort of foremost.
But we have got a history of liking those things. Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. Yeah. The the early writers.
What I was going to say is, having said I don't read horror, then I looked up a list of top 10 horror, and I'd read them all, but they were listed in the classics. Frankenstein, Dracula, Uncle Silas, which is probably the creepiest book, and Sheridan Le Fanu isn't much talked about these days, but he's a great writer of horror. Uncle Silas, it's a Victorian novel, and there's a shorter book, Carmilla, which is the best vampire story you will read, and that's Sheridan Le Fanu. So yes, and the picture of Dorian Gray was listed under horror, which I hadn't sort of thought about it, but it is quite scary. A portrait that ages in the attic and all of that. And
we all see my ex-husband's got one of those. He just doesn't seem to age in real life.
We all know people like that. So yeah, Dracula, Jekyll and Hyde, and The Turn of the Screw, all of those are horror, which I have read, but it's not a genre I turn to readily.
No. It definitely makes me less likely to sleep well at night when I read horror now.
And I wonder if writing horror is scary. I mean, I've never tried to write horror.
Yeah, I wonder if you can scare yourself.
I can make myself cry, so maybe I can.
And if you write erotic fiction and you feel aroused, so maybe when you write horror you feel scared.
Yeah. Perhaps we'll have to try.
Well, maybe somebody that writes horror could tell us what...
Well, I mean, when I was writing Brienne, the thing I found was it was really difficult to make it horrible. I kept trying to make it more horror, but I just wasn't able to do it. It kept feeling too wholesome.
You're just a nice person.
There's definitely a knack to it, I think.
Yeah.
So perhaps our challenge for our next Write Club meeting is to do a little piece that's as horror-filled as possible.
Okay. That's a good challenge.
I just feel so creepy. There are differences, aren't there?
Yeah. I mean, when you said horror, I don't really know what I think of, and then... You mentioned various titles, and you mentioned Dennis O'Keefe. I thought, I read those.
Yeah, again, as a teenager, I didn't. But I've never read of Dennis Wheatley.
Yeah,
I never read Stephen King or.
No, I haven't.
Is James Herbert?
Well, Jaws was the book that scared me. I've never read Silence of the Lambs or seen the film because it scared me.
No. Well, talking about Jaws, because that book and the film has frightened my daughter to death, who's still scared of going in the sea. She's a drama teacher now, and she actually pointed me in the direction of a chap called Stephen Malatrat and a little note that he'd written, and I'll read it out to you. Directors are unlikely to have much experience of ghost plays, as there are relatively few around. So at the risk of stating the obvious, I think it's worth a word or two concerning staging. I've now seen many productions of The Woman in Black around the world, some very effective, others less so. The intent of the show is to frighten, so if it doesn't, it's nothing. The fear is not on a visual or visceral level, but an imaginative one. There are no gouts of blood, nor any but the simplest of special effects. Darkness is a powerful ally of terror. Something glimpsed in the corner is far more frightening than if it's fully observed. Sets work best when they accommodate this, when things unknown might be in places unseen.
Yeah.
I have seen a production where the woman herself was in full light for all of her manifestations and centre stage. Few things could have been less frightening. Mm. In the current London production, we deny the audience a satisfying look at her until the final moment, and only then does she appear in all her terrifying despair. The only aspect of the play that has any claim to complexity is the sound plot. There is also scope, though no obligation, for a wealth of light cues. In general, simple, straightforward staging is the most effective. For example, there are one or two moments when just by raising the volume of the sound cue to an unexpected level, the audience can be shocked to screaming pitch. There are anachronisms and geographical inconsistencies within the text. These are not mistakes, but indications of the Neverland we inhabit when involved with The Woman in Black.
Mm.
Oh, very nice.
If you kind of translate that to writing prose, which is mostly what we're doing, that idea that what you don't see, you don't reveal, the reader gets a glimpse of something, but you don't reveal all. There's a sound behind the door, which is unnerving because there's supposed to be nobody there. It's those kind of elements.
But
that...
It's what Alison was talking about several episodes ago, and she was talking about foreshadowing.
Yes.
I would imagine foreshadowing is a very important part of horror writing.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, it's how you build up to...
If you're looking for ideas, I accidentally strayed into the realm of watching YouTube videos of ghosts caught on CCTV. Mm. And there is, there's some fantastic stories if you look for, you know, unexplained mysteries on CCTV is what you'd search. And there are some really spooky things that have been caught on CCTV and fantastic stories. There was one about a guy that disappeared in a nightclub. He went up, he came up the escalator with his two friends, went into the nightclub, and then they watched the CCTV and he just completely disappeared. And there was another woman who disappeared in a garage, and you could see her coming in and walking about with this other chap. Other chap walks out on the CCTV, woman never found again. No trace of her, no blood, no DNA, no nothing. Yeah. And it's a really good source of mysterious stories.
Ideas.
Yeah.
Stories
of
loose. Yeah.
Well, I was totally horrified one time when my daughter, as in her early teens, went. Seemed to me she just went straight from Judy Blume to Flowers in the Attic and other V.C. Andrews. Was
or started
Andrews,
reading all that stuff.
Yes, and she loves it, and to this day, her favorite genre is still horror. Mm-hmm. And it's something I could never understand because, as I said, I can't read it.
That's a specific kind of horror as well. That's horror visited on children, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, not very
well,
much.
We don't want you all to lose sleep over what we've been talking about. But if you get some clues there to write some stories, then let us know. Well, we're almost at the end. We just want to ask Nicola what's on her bedside table.
Well, interesting you should ask me that, because it's a writer who I've become very, very struck with. He's John Connolly. And he started as a horror writer. And it was only when his friends suggested that he start writing crime fiction that he became really very successful. And he's written Charlie Parker, Detective, PI. He's a private investigator. I'm absolutely delighted in my research to find that he's got 19 Charlie Parker books, and I've only read the first three. He's got... The reason I like it so much is that he's got a really strong range of characters. And Charlie himself is a little bit intriguing because he's a down-to-earth detective and he's a bit like Jack Reacher. He can fight his way out of any situation. But he's got a little sort of spookiness about him. He sees ghosts in woods and things and dead people. He sees dead people, basically. But the other range of characters that are around him are very, very strong. It's set in the Deep South, Linda.
All right.
And it's a really strong sense of place in the same way that some of the other books are. He co-edited... Books to Die For, The World's Greatest Mystery Writers on The World's Greatest Mystery Novels. And that was nominated for the Edgar Award and the Agatha Award. And it won the Agatha Award.
Ah, well, that's a good one for writers, isn't it?
Yeah. So, really, excellent. Really enjoying that.
Mm, okay. I don't want any more on the pile. I've not done that. I've not been as good as everybody else and read loads over the summer. Well, that was Write Club the podcast. Thank you all who take the time to listen to us and get in touch. And let us know what you're writing or reading. You can subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher or Radio Public, so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want. Join our Facebook group. Just search for Write Club the podcast. Please leave a review and do tell your friends about us. Bye.
Bye.